Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
A new global food crisis is emerging from Russia's war in Ukraine, which could see millions of people go hungry, push prices higher, and spark unrest. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres last week urged Russia to release Ukrainian grain and warned of years of mass hunger and famine if nothing is done. Well, my next guest says the UN needs to send forces into Ukraine to shift the grain out of the country. Hamish de Breton Gordon is former British Army officer and fellow at the Magdalen College, Cambridge. I'm also joined on the line by Tim Lang, Professor Emeritus of Food Policy at City University of London. And you're both very welcome. Thank you for joining us on the programme this morning. Hamish, to start with you, you want the UN Secretary General to act now and send a UN force into Ukraine to get grain out of the country. What would be the unintended consequences of that, though? That's the concern, isn't it?
Good morning, Claire. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But Guterres has said millions of people will die if they don't get this grain. And to me, the UN is responsible for humanitarian operations. Now, I know when they did a humanitarian operation in Syria, where I have a lot of experience, they were attacked by the Russians in Aleppo in 2016. So I know that it's a really difficult thing for them to do. But can Guterres say these things and do nothing if he says millions of people are going to die? Now, I'm sure he's correct. Therefore, it must be worth us straining every nerve and sinew to get that grain out, either to ports on the Black Sea or through Europe and on to Africa and Afghanistan, where it's needed. Now, the only way I think that that's going to happen is with the UN forces. Now, Russia is part of the UN. If it attacks its own forces, in effect, then that would be yet another war crime. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important that the only way that we could protect those UN troops is with not necessarily a no-fly zone over all of Ukraine, but some sort of NATO umbrella protecting those trucks and trains full of grain out of Ukraine. The bottom line is, I think the UN really needs to stand up, and particularly Guterres. He highlights the issues that millions of people are going to die, and I think they really need to bend their backs to make sure that we do get that grain out.
So telling us what's going to happen and doing nothing about it as you see it is just simply not good enough.
Well, absolutely. I mean, what is their role? They've identified this issue. We know dreadful things are happening in Ukraine. But are we really going to allow hundreds of thousands of people in Africa and Afghanistan and places like that who rely on Ukrainian grain to die as a second order of consequence of the Russian invasion of Ukraine? I think we must do absolutely everything to make sure that that happens. And although Putin showed that he's got no problems with collateral damage or civilian casualties, that's why I think the UN probably, with the help of NATO, now needs to flex its humanitarian muscles.
Mm-hmm. But we know that a no-fly zone wasn't countenanced to save lives. Are we now saying that we can countenance it to save grain?
Well, I think it's the same thing, really, isn't it? We're talking, Guterres tells us millions will die if we don't get this grain out. I'm not talking about a comprehensive no-fly zone over the whole of Ukraine. I accept that that would really escalate things probably to an area that we just can't accept. However, the NATO does have capabilities, various missiles and intelligence and others, that they could provide additional protection for those convoys of trucks or trains or whatever they are full of grain, moving them across Ukraine outside to us, either ports or into Europe.
Well, let's see what Tim thinks of that. What do you make of that suggestion, Tim?
I'm not surprised at suggestions like this. In a sense, we've got to roll back a bit. What's going on here? A world food system, which is highly stretched, was actually already volatile since the banking and oil crisis of 2007-08. Prices have just gone volatile. They go up and down. They're like spaghetti if you look at them on the graph. And we've had shock after shock, and we're getting more ecosystem shock. In a sense, I understand why Hamish, if I can call you that, is suggesting something like this. It's a dire, quote unquote, solution to a systemic problem. The problem is it can escalate. I was indeed war games scenario planning only last week with a think tank where we were, in fact, exploring things like this. And almost all of these interventions actually up the stakes. I'm not saying we therefore do nothing. Essentially, if the end goal, you've got to be clear about what the end goal is. If you're trying to up the stakes on Russia, we'll think through the consequences very carefully. Mm-hmm. If your end goal is to feed Egypt, the Middle East, the people who are the major recipients whose food prices are rocketing and hunger is going up, well, you've got to think through other ways of doing it. The amount of money you'd spend on the intervention, could you just give it as aid to the countries to maintain their purchasing power? The fundamental thing I do not need to remind an Irish audience is that food follows money. That's why the Irish famine, that's why the Bengal famine, the Sudan, the Bangladesh, it's always lack of money. There's never a shortage of food. Actually, although the Ukraine grain stores are incredibly important, Ukraine's in the top five producers of key edible grains, but also edible oils, rapeseed oil, sunflower oil, etc. So removing those is very important indeed. But it's important because it impacts the price. So if you think about the price, I'm not saying I'm against Hamish's idea. I'm saying it needs to be thought through very carefully. Mm-hmm. Don't just go for one solution to what is a complex, multifactorial problem.
Hamish.
So I'm being a bit cautious.
Okay.
You can tell.
Hamish.
Yeah, I mean, I hear what Tim's saying. And, you know, certainly, you know, at Cambridge, we're looking at these things from a humanitarian perspective. But having been a soldier also for 25 years and been involved in operations, you know, across the globe, you know, I know technically this is possible. And it's really, you know, what is acceptable? We've seen the devastation and the war crimes and the thousands of civilians who've been killed in Ukraine. And I've seen exactly the same in Syria as well. I mean, the UN really failed to operate in Syria. My concern is, you know, it's about time that people like Guterres, when they make these protestations, actually do something rather than this hot air and rhetoric. The UN has the capability to be able to do an operation like this, but it will need additional support from people like NATO and also the Ukraine military. I mean, we can leave it and get on with it, and the second order of consequences to me are as dreadful as doing an operation like this as well. But it needs to be a balance. But to do nothing, I think, is dreadful.
Tim, you agree, do you, that the UN hasn't done enough?
Oh, I do agree with that. But let me say, I'm a UN watcher. Let me tell you, the UN has no powers. Russia is a member of the UN, as you rightly in your introduction, Claire, reminded our listeners and ourselves. But Russia was actually a signatory to European Security Council Resolution 2417 only 5 years ago. Martin McKee, an Irish citizen, and myself wrote a paper in the British Medical Journal at the beginning of this Ukrainian war, reminding people that actually the quote-unquote, the resolutions are actually being ignored. Russia, even in resolution 2417, it's a member of the Security Council, as I'm sure your listeners know, it signed on to this resolution, which is not to use food as a weapon in war. What is food being used in the Ukrainian war as? A weapon. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, Hamish is right to say some of the grain stores are there. But Hamish, I'm sure you'd agree, and the scenario planning that I was involved in last week with this security think tank was actually pointing out, we all agreed, the specialists there, that the loss of this year's planting is going to be even bigger. If you like, the loss of 1 year of grain storage is maybe adaptable if there is financial reward, but the long-term loss of the Ukrainian lands and the destabilization of the loss of Russia from global food trading, that is immense. Okay. And that can't be resolved militarily.
Tim, can
I'm
I
sure
ask
Hamish
you,
knows.
The UN Security Council has heard that the world has about 10 weeks of wheat supplies stored as the war...
If that.
Can you explain to me then how reliant the entire world is on Ukraine for food supply?
Well, it's immense. It's immense both practically, great chunks of the Middle East. It's basically 50 countries import. There are only 190 countries in the world or thereabouts. So it's nearly it's a quarter, roughly, of the world's countries have in recent years been importing from Ukraine. If you look within those, the major countries are actually not all 50 of those, but are North Africa, Egypt, for example, which is a major recipient and has been of American grain. Indeed, America's used grain aid as a political leverage point in Egypt for decades. And then the other area is the Middle East. Now, these are hot areas where Russia is already involved. In a sense, Russia, and I really want people to get their heads around this, Russia is upping the stakes on using food as an act of war, as a control mechanism. Now, you who are in the EU, Brexit land, as you know, voted rightly or wrongly, I think wrongly, but it voted out. We're now seeing Britain in the consequences of having no leverage at the EU level. The good news, Claire and listeners, is that the EU, even though there was pressure to try and say, OK, for this year, we've got to grow more food, actually, the European Union is not short of food. The issue is with a lot of the grain that's grown in Europe is grown and fed to animals. We've got to rethink all of that.
Okay.
And you in Europe have got the farm-to-fork strategy. The farm-to-fork strategy is the new analysis of the EU.
Okay.
Hamish, and it's really good indeed.
Hamish, can I come back?
Because it's not just about production. Okay. It's about the environment and public health.
Just coming back, Hamish.
That's what's going
to cause across you, but
the 21st century.
Hamish, to come back to you on the consequences here, and people will know, we've spoken to you before, you're a nuclear weapons expert. And there's always been a strong suspicion that if, and fear, if NATO engages in any way on this war, and even if that is bringing out trucks of grain or allowing that to happen, that Vladimir Putin could go nuclear. That's the bottom line, isn't it?
I'm not sure it is. I mean, I get slightly concerned when I hear people like Tim talking. We're almost intellectualizing ourselves into doing nothing. And the whole, I think the nuclear issue, obviously, that is what we're trying to avoid at all costs. But Putin is pretty much defeated in Ukraine. We know that. And the way, you know, I cannot see him going strategic nuclear attack because he will lose absolutely everything. But I think it's time that we got more on the front foot with Finland and Sweden joining NATO. I think that's putting additional pressure on Putin to bring him to some sort of negotiation table so that we can stop this dreadful war, get the grain out of Ukraine, get it to people where it's needed, and start to build Ukraine. But basically, Russia has got to be pushed back to where it was in February of this year. But I don't, yeah, just worrying that Putin is going to press that red button as an excuse to do nothing, I think is dreadful. Because, you know, I although I think Putin is an autocrat and pretty much out of control, I am sure there are the checks and balances in the Kremlin, and there are already rumblings of a few good people who are beginning to stand up, who will, I would expect, would stop him pressing that red button.
Okay.
And but it must not make us into inaction through intellectual discussion or fear that he might press that red button. Because otherwise, these millions are going to die.
All right, I've got to leave it there for now. But thank you both, Hamish de Breton Gordon and Tim Lang. Thank you for joining us. Dr. David Coleman is here next.
Today with Claire Byrne. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app.